Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Reacquaint yourself with these classic Western films, turning 50 in 2022. Throughout 2022, we'll be celebrating 50th anniversaries for many films of special interest to CNI readers. These are among the most notable available for streaming or purchase. Bad Company. Texas native Robert Benton, co-scripter of Bonnie and Clyde, Oscar winner for Kramer vs. Kramer and Places in the Heart, justly received acclaim for his debut as a feature director, a picaresque drama about two Civil War draft dodgers, Jeff Bridges and Barry Brown, who turned to outlawry as they head west. Buck and the Preacher. Sidney Poitier, who also directed, rides tall as a former soldier devoted to leading wagon trains of former slaves westward during the post-Civil War era. And Harry Belafonte provides a robust comic relief as a shady fake clergyman who helps Buck battle a vicious white gunman, Cameron Mitchell, hired to scare the ex-slaves back to Louisiana. Chato's Land. 2 years before they collaborated on Death Wish, Charles Bronson and director Michael Winner joined forces to make this violent Western about a half-Apache badass who shoots a sheriff in self-defense, then flees a bloodthirsty posse led by a former Confederate officer, Jack Palance. The Culpeper Cattle Company. After his breakthrough role in Swimmer, Summer of 42, Gary Grimes earned his spurs in director Dick Richards' well-received revisionist Western as an inexperienced cowboy wannabe who joins a cattle drive led by the demanding Frank Culpeper. The Great Northfield, Minnesota Raid. Filmmaker Philip Kaufman draws on the legends of Cole Younger and Jesse James in this colorfully written, richly detailed, and robustly performed Western. Cliff Robertson plays Younger, who advises his men to take a vacation from outlawry while the Missouri legislature considers a bill to grant them amnesty. But hot-headed Jesse James is eager to plunder Northfield, Minnesota, site of one of the biggest banks west of the Mississippi. J.W. Koop. Oscar winner Cliff Robertson directed, produced, co-wrote, and played the title role in his deeply felt road movie about a former professional cowboy who, after serving a lengthy prison term for passing bad checks, seeks a shot at redemption by returning to the rodeo circuit. Jeremiah Johnson. Between Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and The Sting, Robert Redford added another significant notch to his list of signature roles with his authoritative performance in the title role of director Sidney Pollack's rugged Western, inspired by the real-life exploits of a legendary mountain man. Joe Kidd. A hard-drinking but straight-shooting anti-hero has a change of heart after agreeing to help a railroad tycoon ride roughshod over Mexican landowners, defended by a bold revolutionary. Junior Bonner. One of three films about rodeo competitors released in 1972, Sam Peckinpah's atypically gentle drama finds Steve McQueen perfectly cast as professional cowboy with a dysfunctional family that includes a boozy, wastrel father, a stoic but not indefinitely patient mom, and a hard-charging real estate salesman brother. The Honkers. Yet another drama about rodeo competitors, this one starring James Coburn as Lou Lathrop, a middle-aged cowboy and incorrigible womanizer who demands a mite too much from the two men most important people in his life. Cleet, a rodeo clown who is Lou's closest friend and confidant, and Linda, Lou's disapproving but not entirely estranged wife. The Life and Times of Judge Roy Bean, directed by John Huston and scripted by Jeremiah Johnson screenwriter John Milius, this star-studded extravaganza offers a serio-comic take on Wild West mythology, with Paul Newman giving an aptly overstated performance as the title character, an outlaw-turned-town-tamer who metes out rough justice as the law west of the Pecos. The Magnificent Seven Ride. For the third and final sequel to The Magnificent Seven, Lee Van Cleef assumes the Chris Adams ride previously played by Yul Brynner and George Kennedy. After his wife is killed by a gang of outlaws, Adams, accompanied by a reporter determined to write about his exploits, convinces five convicts to join him on the vengeance trail. Pocket Money. Paul Newman and Lee Marvin develop an easygoing give and take in this serio-comic contemporary western directed by Stuart Rosenberg about two none-too-bright drifters who get less than they bargain for when they agree to smuggle cattle across the border from Mexico for a shady rancher. The Revengers. The Wild Bunch stars William Holden and Ernest Borgnine, reteamed in director Daniel Mann's brutal drama about a Colorado rancher who employs six hardened convicts as a posse to pursue the Comancheros who killed his family. And finally, Ulzana's Raid. Working from a screenplay by Alan Sharp, Hollywood icon Robert Aldridge directed this violent western that some critics interpreted as a metaphor for the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. A grizzled Army scout and an inexperienced lieutenant lead troops in pursuit of the Apache warrior Ulzana and his band of followers.
Visions of the West 2022 Photography Contest. We asked for your best shots of the American West, and you more than delivered. Overall winner, Powerful Connections, Chad Coppice. Native winner, Native Reflection, Chad Coppice. One, The Student, Karen Brock. Two, Zola Green, Celeste Rickert. Three, Vision, Dustin Floyd. Four, Carry Forward, Summer Jackman. Five, Pachanka Powwow Grand Entrance Dancers, Daryl Weiser. 6. A Frost in the Air, Danny Nestor. Equine winner, Coming at You, Kim Steed. 1. Dreamy Morning Run, Angie Precure. 2. Effort, Karen Brock. 3. Little Ballerina, Mustang Foe, Dale Moss. 4. Running Free, Gene Merrill. 5. Eye to Eye, Alex Callaghan. 6. Run Wild, Leslie Wasserman. 7. Knee-High Grass, Bill Stipp. 8. Friends, Danny Nestor. Landscape winner, Winter Sunrise, Alabama Hills, Eric Grimm. 1. Morning Mist, Bill Stipp. 2. High Country Meadow, Natalie Heller. 3. The Road to Nowhere, Grand Teton National Park, Tanya Oates. 4. Fall Colors of Idaho, Stanley Harper. 5. Edge of the Storm, Lana Fernandez. 6. A Different View, Maroon Bells, Diane Sandoval. 7. Fall Passage, John E. Trabuco. 8. Sierra Sunrise at Hot Creek, Thomas Kelsey. 9. Teton Reflection, Cody Downard. Wildlife. Wildlife Winter. Winter Wings, Kim Steed. 1. 2-Day-Old Fawns, Dale Moss. 2. Shoefly, Jeff Prisha. 3. Wild Curiosity, John E. Trabuco. 4. Tender Moments, Tammy Cockjohn. 5. Fierce, Emily Perrin. 6. Moose Dining, Danette Largay. 7. Guy, Alex Callaghan. 8. Swabacker Landing, James Evangelista. 9. Glacier Eagle, Molly Oxford. Ranch and Rodeo. Ranch and Rodeo Winner, Ranch Hands of Raton, Lindsay Donner. 1. Nosy Rosie, Taylor Kuntz. 2. Mission Mountains Rodeo, David Klumpner. 3. Untitled, Maggie Goddard. 4. Rear Out Camp Croc, Kristen Schur. 5. Riding at Sunset, Lori Sahagunas. Exploring America's Outback. Adventurer and celebrated lensman and author John Anarino guides readers through bucket list travels in a breathtaking new photography book, America's Outback, an odyssey through the Great Southwest. My passion for photography evolved from guiding students and clients on challenge discovery type wilderness journeys, hiking, climbing, and camping among the deserts, canyons, mesas, and mountains of the Great Southwest, Arizona, and Sonora, Mexico. Our memorable adventures included forays to the summits of Geronimo's Chiricahua Mountains, homelands, the legendary treasure trove of the Superstition Mountains, the sacred heights of the San Francisco Mountains' Kachina Peaks, once remote Grand Canyon indigenous-turned-prospector trails, and solo adventures on Tiburon Island in the Sea of Cortez, Mexico. Everywhere we ventured, I carried my camera dangling from my neck as at the ready. At one point, while working as a Grand Canyon boatman on the Colorado River, I think it was my 18th trip, they were all mesmerizing, I decided to move on from what someone's view as a lifelong career of you never go down the same river twice to pursue photography full time. But no one was looking for a shy photographer based out of a sleepy mountain hideaway outside Prescott, Arizona. I cowboyed up, as the townsfolk call it, and knocked on doors in San Francisco, New York, and Phoenix, and storyboarded photo essays I shot on self-assignments. The thematic photo essays included Rough Stock, Behind the Chutes, The Toughest Events in Rodeo, River Wranglers, Whitewater Rafting the Forks of the Kern River with Pack Horse Support, High Risk Photography, The Adventure Behind the Image, the name of my first photography book, Charros, America's First Cowboys, shot on spec during the National Charro Congress in Guanajuato, Mexico, Apache, The Sacred Path to Womanhood, it became a book by that name, White Water Women, and other self-assignments.
the first big win. One day I walked out to the mailbox and the Paris agency Gamma Liaison had mailed me a check that made me gasp. The tear sheet they included was my photo of the Eagle Tail Mountains in Arizona, plastered across a roadside billboard in Amsterdam. What? It became one of my stock photo bestsellers. I had discovered an image revenue stream and apparently an eager audience for the landscapes, people, ceremonies, traditions, and adventures I photographed in the Great Southwest. They were heady days for an Arizona photographer, going from pitching projects to haughty New York magazine editors to photography, a life assignment of an outward-bound canoe expedition down Big Bend's Rio Grande. I was just breaking into life, and I had little savings to fly into a remote airstrip near some outpost called Presidio, Texas, to photograph Fortune 500 executives tipping over their canoes, swimming and portaging rapids they'd never forget. Peering at the office walls of life, I'd studied the framed photographs of the legendary photographers that made the magazine. W. Eugene Smith, Margaret Burke, White, Gordon Parks, Larry Burroughs, Harry Benson, Dorothea Lange, and too many others to name here. Missing were the framed images I'd viewed in the offices of Sierra Club Books, Ansel Adams, Elliot Porter, Philip Hyde, and Galen Rowell. So too were the color images that hung on the walls of Arizona Highways magazine. Ray Manley, Esther Henderson, Barry Goldwater, and David Munch. I'd found my calling, though I wondered how I'd synthesize the influences in my own vision from the three publications that were giving me assignments. Missing from everyone's walls were the works of Peter Beard, Edward Curtis, John Hillers, and Timothy O'Sullivan, who also inspired me. I pivoted into photography book publishing, which I had set my sights on from the very beginning. I attended book expos in Chicago, New York, Las Vegas, and Los Angeles to meet and greet publishers and editors face to face. At an expo in New York, I'd made an appointment beforehand with Sierra Club Books publisher to pitch my photography book, Canyons of the Southwest. In a voice that sounded like the rasp of a butcher's broom, he said, "You've got 5 minutes." I handed him a sheet of 20 35mm color transparencies. Today it's a tablet or mini laptop. He held it up to the fluorescent lighting, turned to me and said, "I could sell this. Follow me." He walked me through the convention center to Random House's aisle of booths crowded with authors, book buyers, and publishers. He gave the flimsy sheet of images to a Random House senior editor he knew. The pinstriped editor held it up to the light, and the deal was done with a handshake on the spot. That book opened the door to my career in photography book publishing. One book led to the next that spanned the Great Southwest and Central America. Then I rode off into the sunset with saddlebags stuffed with royalties that were more like the washers from Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch and the gal of my dreams. So I'd thought. It didn't get easier. It was a glorious-looking but lean vocation, and it was rarely a slam dunk getting the next book greenlit. Photography books cost a fortune to publish, and the burden was or is on the photographer to convince a publisher that the theme, imagery, content, and market are worth their roll of the dice. After years of exploring the Great Southwest, it was plain to me that the extraordinary geography was sculpted by forces of nature that touched my soul. Volcanic mountain islands erupted high above desert seas.
sometimes creating elliptical craters that resembled the surface of the moon. Thundering cataracts tumbled into flood-swollen rivers that carved deep chasms through cliffs, canyons, and sierras. Towering monuments and mysterious hoodoos, honed by wind, water, and stone-splitting, freeze-thaw erosion, resembled ancient deities like the Navajo's Haché, Diné, holy people who turned to stone. Mystifying stone and otherworldly figures, etched and painted by native hands, remain hidden among wind-scoured terracotta mesas that stretched across the four corners and painted desert region from one glorious sunrise to the next. A quote from America's Outback, an Odyssey Through the Great Southwest. America's Outback was photographed in the American West, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, West Texas, California, Old Mexico, Baja California, Norte, Sonora, Chihuahua, Coahuila, and U.S.-Mexico borderlands. Oft times, my attempts to reach intimidating camera perches for the book necessitated climbing and bivouacking alone atop remote mountain peaks and crests to photograph sunsets and sunrises from the aerial perspective of a raptor. There was no better reward for these efforts. Many of the book's color photographs are paired with literary quotes from the great Southwest's early travelers, authors, characters, and native peoples to illuminate the landscapes they traveled through and exemplify how their wanderings changed, inspired, and often repelled them. I'd made it my mission to go off the grid into the Southwest's unknown lands where my spirit touched down, take seldom-seen remote exposures, and photograph affable locals and their enduring traditions. I explored it by foot, raft, rope, canoe, sea kayak, seagoing panga, and, ill-advisedly, from the back of an ornery mule. I wanted to disappear into the landscape to photograph my journeys with the colors of the earth, note my perceptions, and compose evocative essays. My hope for readers is that they are reminded of a real world that exists far beyond their hypnotic cell phone screens. It's waiting to be discovered by back road or waterway, footpath, cross country, horse, or muleback. Venture beyond your horizon line. Breathe in the air. Take in the extraordinary views. The American Outback is like no place on earth.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine, February-March 2022 edition. The article I'm reading is The Top 10 True Western Towns of 2022 by Peter Corbett, and I'll begin with number 10 and work our way down to number 1. Number 10, Virginia City, Nevada City, Montana. Yellowstone National Park is only 90 minutes from Virginia City and Nevada City, Montana, but it's a time travel journey back to the 1860s when a placer gold strike spawned these frontier towns. Visitors discover adjacent mining camps with hundreds of buildings and homes that have maintained their historic character thanks to local and state preservation efforts. Those who take the back roads to get here are rewarded, said David Bacon, Virginia City councilman and volunteer fireman. I think once they get here, they realize how important the history is, he said. This is literally the birthplace of Montana. The first legislature ever in Montana met in a building down on Main Street, which is still there. Virginia City, the first state capital from 1865 to 75, has the oldest operating retail store, Rank's Mercantile, that's still running after 158 years. It has Montana's oldest saloon, the Bale of Hay, established in 1867. When people start wandering around, they realize This is the real stuff. In May 1863, prospectors discovered placer gold in Alder Creek in southwestern Montana. Virginia City, Nevada City, and other mining camps were quickly established along a 14-mile stretch of the creek. The population boomed to more than 8,000 and attracted some unsavory characters, but vigilantes rounded up five highwaymen in January 1864 and hanged them at a building that's still standing. The bandits are buried in Virginia City's Boot Hill Cemetery. Number 9. Bandera, Texas. Skeptics of Bandera's bold claim of being the cowboy capital of the world should visit the town plaza. That's where a Texas Historical Commission marker, signed by two congressmen and the governor, says it is so. The Texas Hill Country town, founded by entrepreneurs on the Medina River 170 years ago, has the bona fides to back that claim, according to Patricia Moore, Bandera County Tourism Bureau Executive Director. Bandera earned its spurs as a staging area for cowboys and cattle drives on the Western Trail, with more than 7 million longhorns passing through between 1874 to 94. Nearly four decades later, Bandera became a hub for dude ranches. Rodeos have gained in popularity during the past century, with at least 18 events planned at Bandera's Mansfield Park this year. "We're authentic," Moore said. "We're not a movie town. We're a town that loves everything about living in the West." The Dixie Dude Ranch, the area's oldest, is celebrating its 85th anniversary. The focal point for Bandera is the OST Restaurant, shorthand for Old Spanish Trail. It celebrated its centennial in 2021. Bandera is known for its music scene. The now-closed Cabaret Dance Hall was country swinging for close to 80 years, with acts ranging from Bob Wills to Robert Earl Keen and Steve Earle. Arky Blue Silver Dollar is a lively Texas honky-tonk, and the 11th Street Cowboy Bar is hosting its Cowboy Mardi Gras on February 17th through the 19th. Bandera's Frontier Times Museum has a collection of pioneer relics and a Texas Heroes Hall of Fame that includes writer and folklorist J. Frank Dobie, singer-humorist Kinky Friedman, and Gary P. Nunn, known for his song London Homesick Blues. Number 8. Dodge City, Kansas. In its early days on the Kansas frontier, Dodge City was known as the wickedest little city in America, for good reason. The reputation of the city has not been first class for peace and quietness, reported the Leavenworth Daily Commercial in February 1873. As is natural with all new Western towns, it has been made a headquarters for all the roughs of the land, who congregated here for the purpose of carrying on their nefarious business of murder and rapine, plunder. 17 of these outlaws repose quietly beneath the sod on the banks of the Arkansas River. Modern Dodge City has traded on that nefarious reputation to bring visitors to this Wild West town and to enjoy newer amenities that pay homage to its frontier legacy. The town will celebrate its 150th anniversary in 2022. That includes Dodge City Days, a 10-day celebration that features a parade, concerts, Western art shows, a Longhorn cattle drive, and a PRCA rodeo. A new event, Founders Weekend, has been added to the calendar to honor George Hoover, who in 1872 set up the first business in what would become Dodge City. It was a saloon, initially operated out of a sod hut. The Long Branch Saloon, which operated from 1874 to 85, was Dodge City's most famous watering hole. It served booze to Western legends Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, and Bat Masterson. The saloon gained fame as a focal point of Gunsmoke, a TV Western set in Dodge City. A recreation of the Long Branch is one of the many features at Dodge City's Boot Hill Museum. Other Dodge City attractions include the Santa Fe Depot, Mueller Schmidt House, and Boot Hill Distillery. Number 10, Cheyenne, Wyoming. Visitors to Cheyenne should not be surprised if they find themselves looking at locomotives and soaking up railroad history in a spectacular 1886 depot. Cheyenne is first and foremost a railroad town, explained Jim Walter, Visit Cheyenne's vice president. That's why we're here. It was the best place to get across the Rockies. The Union Pacific Railroad built the Cheyenne Depot, and it's described as the last of the grand railroad stations on the transcontinental route. The Depot Museum features a model train exhibit and details on massive steam and diesel electric locomotives. Because of the steep grades to the west, Cheyenne was home to the largest steam-powered locomotives. One of the so-called big boys is on display in nearby Holiday Park. Another big draw is Cheyenne Frontier Days, billed as the world's largest outdoor rodeo and western celebration. Held since 1897, it attracts close to 250,000 spectators over 10 days, Walter said. Visitors might also enjoy the Nelson Museum of the West, with exhibits on lawmen, outlaws, and the wealthy cattle barons who made Cheyenne the Paris of the West. A train at Terry Bison Ranch takes passengers for a tour of the ranch and for up-close but safe encounters with bison. We take a lot of pride here in maintaining an authentic Western experience for people, Walter said. Number 6, Deadwood, South Dakota. Gold strikes in the mid-1870s in the Black Hills led to the founding of Deadwood, and by the end of 1876, more than 3,000 prospectors and other fortune seekers crowded into the fledgling town. Modern Deadwood, a National Historic District, celebrates its boomtown roots with its Days of 76 celebration in late July. It includes a parade of horse-drawn carriages, Native American dance performances, and what is touted as the best rodeo, no bull. This year's celebration is extra special since it's the 100th anniversary of the Days of 76. In July 1922, the Daily Deadwood Pioneer Times reported on plans for the event. Quote, "The finishing touches are being added to the Legion Building, where the Days of 76 will be staged each night of the roundup. Here you will find the scenes of those thrilling days enacted in a manner that will make you think the pages of time turn back nearly a half century. There will be barrels and barrels of fun and other things on tap each night." Deadwood will also celebrate Wild Bill Days, June 16th through the 18th, with music and gold panning lessons. Legendary gunfighter Wild Bill Hickok was shot to death in a Deadwood saloon August 2, 1876, and is buried in the town cemetery next to Calamity Jane. Number 5, Durango, Colorado. In July 1882, the tracks of the Denver and Rio Grande Railroad were completed from Durango to Silverton in southwestern Colorado's San Juan Mountains. Today, 140 years later, that rail line still carries passengers on the Durango and Silverton Narrow Gauge Railroad. The steam-powered train, which appeared in the 1969 Western classic Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, is Durango's most sublime Western experience. The sound of the steam locomotive's whistle is a charming throwback to the town's 19th century beginnings. The historic ambiance is kept alive in Durango's historic district by three vintage hostelries: the 130-year-old Rochester Hotel, the 1898 General Palmer Hotel, built by Civil War General William Jackson Palmer of the Union Army, and the 135-year-old Strader Hotel, with its Diamond Bell Saloon and guest room number 222, where Louis L'Amour wrote westerns. Durango is also known as a base camp for outdoor adventures, skiing and snowboarding, whitewater paddling and mountain biking, According to Rachel Welch, communications manager at Visit Durango, it's the very quintessential mountain town, but without the ego, she said. It has the history. It has the food, the great food. You have the river. You have the mountains. You can never get bored here. Annual events include a festival known as Snowdown in late January, the Bluegrass Meltdown in April, and a cowboy poetry gathering in late September. Number 4, Tombstone, Arizona. Tombstone's devotion to preserving its history and a succession of Hollywood movies keep attracting visitors to Dusty Allen Street. It's been just over 140 years since the shootout at the OK Corral, and people from all over the globe show up here to walk in the footsteps of the lawmen and the outlaws who clashed in deadly gunfights. Cochise County was the last part of the United States to have law and order, and that's reflected in our town's history with the gunfight, which still leads to most of our tourism, said Jonathan Donahue, Tombstone Marketing Director. We're a real town. If you come here, you don't have to pay admission. You're in an old West town. You have no fast food. We have no stoplights. Tombstone does have its historic 1880s saloons on Allen Street, the Crystal Palace and the Oriental, where Wyatt Earp had a piece of the gambling action. Other popular watering holes are Big Nose Kate's and Tombstone Brewing Company, which serves Helles Durango Lager. It's a fitting beer for the Helldorado Days, one of Tombstone's major events, set for October 21st and 22nd this year. Another top event is Wyatt Earp Days on May 28th and 29th. Day trips are popular for Arizona visitors, but Tombstone encourages overnight stays in its hotels and B&Bs. If visitors come here for more than a day and walk around at 6 in the evening on the boardwalk with the sun going down, it's like going back in time to the 1880s, Donahue said. Number 3, Casper, Wyoming. Before Casper was incorporated as a town in 1889, hundreds of thousands of immigrants passed through the central Wyoming on the Oregon, California, and Mormon trails. Modern Casper pays homage to that history with the 20-year-old National Historic Trails Interpretive Center. Visitors can learn about those trails and the immigrants who traveled 2,000 miles by wagon to reach their destinations in the mid-19th century. Historic Trails West, run by private outfitter Morris Carter, takes visitors on those trails in recreated covered wagons on trips ranging in length from 2 hours to 5 days. The longer trek reaches Scenic Pass, where the trails split. It's quite an experience for modern travelers, Carter said. They can see these great, big, wide-open vistas and travel back in time in their mind, and they can visualize an entire long line of wagons and people walking beside them. The museum at recreated Fort Casper focuses on the area's military history. The fort, which includes a replica of Mormon ferry boat, was named for Lieutenant Casper Collins, who was killed by Indians in 1865. He is the town's namesake, but the spelling of his name was mistakenly altered. Today, Casper is known for the College National Finals Rodeo, which attracts big crowds in June. Casper is also home to Lou Talbot Ranch Outfitters, a 55,000-square-foot store in a historic downtown building with a 3-story neon sign. It opened in 1917 in Fort Laramie and moved to Casper 30 years later. Number 2. Prescott, Arizona. Prescott ranks high as a true Western town for its historic rodeo, a deep embrace of its frontier history, and the silver screen and real cowboys who have made their homes here. Tom Mix, King of the Cowboys, shot more than 100 Westerns at Granite Dells and other area locations during the silent movie era. Early Hollywood royalty Mix lived for several years at his Bar Circle A ranch, now part of Prescott, known as Yavapai Hills. Oklahoma claims Tom Mix, but this was his workplace, said Prescott historian Drew Desmond. He spent many years here, many summers here, and one all-around cowboy in 1913 at the world's oldest rodeo in Prescott. The rodeo, held since 1888 and Frontier Days in July, are Prescott's signature events. Famous Prescott cowboy J.C. Trujillo is a local kid who got his start at the Prescott Rodeo at age 6 and went on to win dozens of belt buckles and a world championship in bareback riding in 1981. Trujillo, now 73, is in the Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame. Another silver screen cowboy who helped out Prescott on the true Western town map was Steve McQueen, who starred in Junior Bonner, a 1972 Sam Peckinpah movie filmed in town and at the rodeo. Prescott is gearing up to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Junior Bonner in conjunction with Frontier Days, according to Desmond, author of Murder and Mayhem in Prescott. History is nearly a civic religion in Prescott, with a legacy going back to its territorial capital days. It's so much a part of the Prescott tapestry. The citizenry just gets so involved with it, Desmond said. The town's most important havens of history include Charlotte Hall Museum, Western Heritage Center, and the Museum of Indigenous People. Prescott has long been known for Whiskey Row, a stretch of saloons on Montezuma Street that includes Matt's, Jersey Lily, Birdcage, and The Palace, one of Arizona's oldest bars, open since 1877. Number 1. San Angelo, Texas. M.L. Letty's of San Angelo has been making Western boots for a century. The family business has amassed stacks of bank ledger books with foot measurements for hundreds of thousands of customers who have bought Letty's handmade boots. The boot and Western wear company, celebrating its centennial this year, is among San Angelo businesses and craftsmen who make saddles, boots, hats, and spurs, reflecting on the town's Western heritage. We have a lot of other folks who are the old school makers of saddles to spurs and all those things, said Diane Bays, San Angelo Convention and Visitors Bureau Vice President. Those are lost arts, but we continue to have that in our city. San Angelo has deep roots with the founding of Fort Concho in 1867, and it has honored its history, preserving 23 of the garrison's buildings and keeping its Western traditions alive. San Angelo will celebrate its 90th annual Stock Show and Rodeo this year, with livestock events in February and the rodeo in April. The Cowboy Gathering, country and Western swing music festival in its 10th year, features more than a dozen bands in early September. San Angelo's mayor owns Miss Hattie's Restaurant and Cat House Lounge on historic Concho Street in a restored 1880s building. There's also Miss Hattie's Bordello Museum, named for a legendary madam who plied her trade here. Overnight visitors might enjoy the Old Central Firehouse Bed and Brew. The 1929 firehouse features a pizzeria and tap room downstairs, plus a handful of second floor rooms. Other attractions, the Railway Museum in a restored 1909 depot, Museum of Fine Arts, and the Riverwalk along the Concho River. Visitors who count sheep might notice San Angelo has about 100 painted ceramic sheep scattered around the city. The sculptures represent bygone days when San Angelo was the mohair and wool capital of the world. And with that, I'm going to move to read an article from True West Magazine, December 1999. Roundup, Fort Concho Soldiers On, by David F. Crosby. The Old West died hard in Texas, and Fort Concho, where many of the units and men who wrote much of Texas's military history lived, worked, and played, still soldiers on. Cavalrymen of Colonel Ranald McKenzie's 4th Cavalry, or Buffalo soldiers of Colonel Benjamin Grierson's 10th Cavalry, no longer ride out onto the desolate staked plains of Texas in search of Comanches, but living history units still form there to remind us that they once did. Today, Fort Concho serves Texas as a historical monument and Old West military museum. The living history groups that call Fort Concho home maintain the barracks, making the beds, storing their tin cups and coffee pots, and the other odds and ends of Old West soldiering, giving the old limestone and pecan wood billets the feel and smell of real history. The fort claims one of the few Buffalo Soldier living history groups in the nation, and the soldiers participate in special events at Fort Concho and across the state. The Buffalo Soldiers and the other living history groups muster at the fort every June during the Frontier Day celebration. Fort Concho visitors discover interpretive guides manning the barracks, ready to explain the enlisted man's day-to-day life. During the Indian Wars, it was not an easy life. Low pay, $13 for a private, isolation, sunstroke, heat and frostbite, cold, harsh punishment, enlisted men were sometimes hung by their thumbs, and a monotonous fare of hardtack, salt pork, and beans led to a high desertion rate. Life in the field was worse. A patrol could stretch for hundreds of miles across barren plains. In 1877, during a hot pursuit of Indians, four troopers from Company A, 10th Cavalry, stationed at Fort Concho, died of thirst. The remainder of the company survived, but just barely. They drank the urine and blood from their dead horses to make it to a waterhole. Built in 1867 as one in a line of forts that stretched across Texas' frontier, Fort Concho held the strategic center of the line near the confluence of the Concho Rivers. Designed to thwart Indian attacks on frontier settlements, its troopers witnessed plenty of action. Famous warriors like Ranald S. McKenzie, Wesley Merritt, William R. Schaffner, and Benjamin H. Grierson commanded the fort during its active life. By 1889, with the Comanche Wars long over, Fort Concho no longer had a purpose, and its flag was lowered for the last time. Unlike many other frontier forts, a sizable civilian town had taken permanent root nearby, and the townspeople quickly took over the fort's abandoned storage space and housing. San Angelo has restored and rebuilt most of Fort Concho's original buildings, making it the most complete Indian Wars era fort west of the Mississippi. Within its 40-acre National Historic Landmark stands 16 original limestone buildings, 5 reconstructed buildings, and 1 stabilized ruin. The structures include enlisted barracks, officers' quarters, the hospital, post headquarters, chapel, and quartermaster building. The enlisted barracks and mess hall were built in the early 1870s, and the original limestone walls remain today. During renovation, Barracks 1 and 2 became the visitor center and gift store, and Barracks 5 and 6 replicated the billets of a typical Fort Concho company. Mess Hall 5, directly behind the barracks, contains all the furnishings of an 1870s military dining hall. 9 sets of officers' quarters stretch along officers' row. The largest, quarters number 1, was the commanding officer's home. Colonel Grierson lived in this particular house from 1875 to 1885. Each house has its own history and is furnished with period furniture and household items. The Robert Wood Johnson Museum of Frontier Medicine occupies the post hospital. The museum's exhibits display the medicines, instruments, and sanitation measures that contract surgeons use to try and fight disease, the real enemy at any frontier post. Built in 1876, the post headquarters building served as the nerve center for Fort Concho. The post commander and his adjutant ran the post and the regiment from this limestone and pecan wood structure. The post adjutant was the commanding officer's chief aide, and it was he who issued the rules, policies, and paperwork that turned the commander's orders into actions. The adjutant's office, the clerk and orderly room, and the court-martial room appear as they did when Grierson ruled the building, the post, and the 10th Cavalry. The building also houses the Fort Concho Museum. The chapel started out as the kitchen of a planned addition to the officers' row. When the project was abandoned in 1879, the base chaplain convinced Grierson to convert the structure into a small chapel that would double as a schoolhouse. At the time, teaching was a chaplain's primary duty. Black units, the only Army units authorized for chaplains during the Indian Wars period, held a large number of former slaves, most illiterate. The chaplain's job was to teach them to read and write so that they could rise to the non-commissioned ranks. He also taught Fort Concho's children. Today, the chapel is outfitted as a frontier school. The Quartermaster Building, the second oldest structure in San Angelo, now serves as the home for the San Angelo Museum of Fine Arts. The works of many famous and talented artists now fill the rooms and halls where soldiers were once issued uniforms and equipment. During its founding years, Fort Concho soldiers stayed on the defensive, providing escorts to supply trains, stagecoaches, and pursuing raiders of nearby settlers. In September 1869, all that changed when Colonel Ranald S. McKenzie assumed command of the post. McKenzie went on the offensive. Often combining forces with other Texas forts, he pursued and fought the Comanches. None of these battles proved decisive, but each was a learning experience for McKenzie. In the Red River War of 1874-1875, McKenzie used his hard-earned knowledge to win the Battle of Palo Duro Canyon and sweep Comanches off the Llano Estacado for good. In the field, with 8 troops of cavalry, Fort Concho's Buffalo soldiers among them, McKenzie's camped on the night of September 26, 1874, at Tool Canyon. That night, the Comanches attacked and tried to drive his horses off. McKenzie, using a tactic he had learned from his days at Fort Concho, had anticipated the move and had his horses hobbled, cross-lined, and heavily guarded. Thwarted, the enemy withdrew and resorted to harassing sniper fire for the remainder of the night. At dawn, McKenzie drove them off. It soon became obvious why the Comanches had tried to drive his horses off. The Tonkawa scouts reported finding a large camp in Palo Duro Canyon. Palo Duro had long been a favorite haunt for Comanches. It offered water, forage, and its steep walls delayed and channeled anyone who sought to attack them. Colonel McKenzie knew the defensive advantages that the canyon offered the Comanches, but from his Fort Concho field experience, he remembered one fatal flaw in Comanche culture. Warriors followed the orders of a war chief only when they felt like it. That made night guards around a Comanche camp a lax affair. In the dim light of dawn on September 28, 1874, McKenzie ordered his troops to dismount and lead their horses in a single file down a narrow, steep trail on the face of Palo Duro Canyon and form an attack on the canyon floor. 3 companies reached the canyon floor before an alarm swept through the Comanche camp. The companies on the floor charged the surprised Comanches as their companions continued down the rocky face. As the cavalrymen rode among the teepees firing, the warriors fled in a rout, racing for cover beyond the camp. They returned fire from the boulders and brush and forced the troopers to dismount. The battle disintegrated into a sniping contest, but the troopers continued to receive reinforcements from the rim of the canyon wall, and the tide of the battle was clear for all to see. The warriors made one last attempt to recover their horse herd from the troopers, then scattered into the canyon. As the guns fell silent, only four warriors lay dead and one trooper wounded. Mackenzie ordered the captured teepees and Comanche supplies torched, and then drove the 1,424 Comanche horses he had captured to Toole Canyon. In 1872, while commanding Fort Concho, Mackenzie had fought Moway's Comanche band in the Battle of McClellan Creek. He had defeated Moway and captured his horse herd. The night after the battle, Moway stole his own horses back, and most of Mackenzie's. Like all good commanders, Mackenzie learned from his mistakes. Ordering a few hundred of the best mounts cut from the herd of his own men, he ordered the rest, over 1,000, shot. He then posted a large guard on his own horses and sealed the Comanche's fate. Adrift on the endless staked plains as winter approached, without food, shelter, and on foot, the Comanches had no choice but to turn themselves in to the agencies. Organized Comanche resistance was forever broken, and the men and tactics learned at Fort Concho played a prominent role in their defeat. Tragically, the architect of the Battle of Palo Duro Canyon and former commander of Fort Concho would lose his most important battle. Graduating first in his West Point class on June 17, 1862, Mackenzie fought his way to brevet major general by the end of the Civil War, seeing action in Manassas, Chancellorsville, Gettysburg, and Petersburg along the way. Retaining the rank of colonel during the Civil War, reduction of the regular army, Mackenzie once again proved himself a military prodigy, serving on the frontier. President Ulysses Grant referred to him as the most promising officer in the army. Despite the promotion stagnation that doomed most officers to retire as lieutenants or captains, he wore the star of a brigadier general once again on October 26, 1882. Sadly, only 17 months later, on March 24, 1884, he would retire in defeat, insane from syphilis, an unfit end for a fine soldier. Many fine units called Fort Concho home during its 22 years of active service. The famous 4th and 10th Cavalries claimed it as their regimental headquarters, along with the 11th and 16th Infantries. Troops of the 3rd, 8th, and 9th Cavalries, and companies of the 17th, 19th, 24th, and 25th Infantries, also called the fort home. Today, you will find Fort Concho inside the San Angelo city limits at 213 East Avenue D. The Fort Concho Museum is open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and on Sunday, 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. For a schedule of special events, write Fort Concho, 213 East Avenue D, San Angelo, Texas, 76903. For more information, call 325-657-4441.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.